From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
As you know, in the United States, Congress has a very aggressive schedule to legislate sweeping changes to our financial system that are going to provide greater protection for consumers and investors, to create a more stable financial system, and to try to make sure that taxpayers are no longer on the hook in the future to bear the burdens of financial crises.
Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner speaking on the eve of the G20 summit in Pittsburgh. We'll talk about the prospects for financial regulatory reform at the G20 with the head of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, Lori Wallach. And as world leaders gather at the conference, police are cracking down on protests in the streets. We'll get a report. Then Nobel Peace Prize-winning Kenyan environmentalist Wangari Maathai.
We are all in this together, irrespective of our level of contribution to the problem. Business as usual for any one country would be a tragedy.
And the UN Security Council holds a special summit to discuss nuclear nonproliferation and disarmament. We'll talk to John Burroughs of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy. All that and more coming up. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez. The New York Times is reporting the U.S. is preparing to accuse Iran of building a secret underground facility to produce nuclear fuel. President Obama will reportedly make the announcement at the G20 summit in Pittsburgh later today. The alleged site is not yet operational. The Obama administration says it decided to make the allegations public after discovering Iran was aware Western intelligence agencies had monitored the site. Earlier today, European officials said Iran notified the International Atomic Energy Agency of a previously undisclosed uranium enrichment plant earlier this week. The UN Security Council has unanimously passed a resolution to limit nuclear proliferation. The U.S. drafted measure calls for further efforts to achieve a world without nuclear weapons. But critics say it fails to include mandatory provisions that would have required nuclear states to take concrete disarmament steps. The resolution also lacks any call on states to halt production of fissile materials for nuclear weapons. President Obama became the first U.S. president to chair a U.N. Security Council summit, which also marked the fifth summit-level meeting of the Council in its 63 years of existence.
In the six-plus decades that this Security Council has been in existence, only four other meetings of this nature have been convened. I called for this one so that we may address at the highest level a fundamental threat to the security of all peoples and all nations, the spread and use of nuclear weapons.
We'll have more on the Security Council nuclear vote later in the broadcast. In Afghanistan, five U.S. troops were killed Thursday in two southern provinces. 34 U.S. troops have been killed in Afghanistan this month. Last year was the deadliest month for the United States, with 51 soldiers killed. In Pakistan, at least four people were killed Thursday in a suspected U.S. airstrike. The attack reportedly struck a town in the North Waziristan tribal region. It comes as the U.S. Senate has approved a measure that would triple Pakistani aid to $7.5 billion over 5 years. The Senate Finance Committee has rejected a proposal that would have forced pharmaceutical companies to lower drug prices for elderly Americans under Medicare. The measure would have saved Medicare beneficiaries more than $100 billion over 10 years. The Obama administration had opposed the proposal because it would have undercut a secretive deal with the pharmaceutical companies to back health care reform. Three Democratic senators, Max Baucus of Montana, Thomas Carper of Delaware, and Robert Menendez of New Jersey, joined with the finance panel's Republican members to defeat the amendment by a 13-10 vote. Committee members, meanwhile, have put off debate on a public insurance option until next week. A Colorado man, jailed since last week, has been charged with conspiring to launch a bomb attack inside the United States. 24-year-old Najibullah Zazi is accused of acquiring and preparing explosive materials similar to those used in the 2005 London transit bombings. Prosecutors say Zazi brought chemicals from beauty supply stores and experimented with preparing deadly explosives. It's unclear if authorities believe Zazi intended to attack a specific target. Zazi was initially arrested along with his father and a New York imam on allegations of lying to federal agents. On Thursday, both the father and the imam were freed on bail. The imam, Ahmad Waiz Abzali, denied the allegations against him.
Islamic as imam is against Islamic law to hurt anybody, period. I'm very much against this myself, very much against this. And the last time I saw Zazi was God knows how many years ago. That's about it.
In Honduras, the ousted president, Manuel Zelaya, says preliminary talks with the coup regime have gone nowhere. On Thursday, Zelaya said there is no chance of reaching an agreement with coup leaders and vowed to continue his attempt to return to office. Zelaya remains holed up inside the Brazilian embassy, surrounded by armed Honduran forces. In a separate interview, Zelaya accused the Honduran military of subjecting him and his supporters to toxic gases and radiation. The White House is disavowing a top official's promise to block a recent UN report's recommendations to refer alleged Israeli war crimes potentially to the International Criminal Court. The Jewish Telegraphic Agency reported this week a top White House official had made the promise in an off-the-record conversation with Jewish leaders. The official apparently said the administration would not allow the report's recommendations to go beyond the UN Human Rights Council. A White House spokesperson later said the official had misspoken. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez was among the world leaders speaking Thursday at the United Nations General Assembly. Chavez invoked his 2006 speech in which he called former President George W. Bush a devil and said he now senses hope with President Obama in office. But Chavez criticized what he called the continued dominance of the Pentagon.
The Pentagon, that is the imperialist's cave. The Pentagon does not want Obama. They don't want him. They don't want change. They want world dominance with their military bases, their threats, their bombs, their invading soldiers.
Chavez went on to criticize Obama's recent UN address, saying plans for U.S. military bases in Colombia contradict Obama's stated commitment to peace.
He thinks of finding peace, his second pillar, with seven military bases in Colombia. Those seven bases are a threat to a possible peace in Colombia, if not peace in South America. We, the governments of South America, have reason to have expressed in each our own way and intensity our great worry over the installation of these seven American military bases on Colombian territory.
The Obama administration has announced it's begun direct engagement with the Burmese military junta in a push for democratic reforms. The U.S. isn't lifting sanctions, but says it will increase dialogue with junta members. The approach has drawn backing from leading Burmese democracy advocates, including the jailed opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi. A new study says global warming is increasing at a higher rate than previously thought. The United Nations Environment Program says researchers now predict the planet's temperature will rise 6.3 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century, even if the most ambitious proposals to address climate change are enacted. The temperature rise is 2 times higher than what scientists have previously identified as the maximum humans can afford to avert a climate disaster. Back in the United States, Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick has named former Democratic National Committee Chair Paul Kirk to the Senate seat vacated by the death of the late Senator Edward Kennedy. Kirk was said to be the pick of Kennedy's family. He will fill the seat until Massachusetts holds a special election in January. And in California, thousands of professors, students, and workers at all 10 University of California campuses staged a protest Thursday against tuition hikes and cuts to education funding. Student tuition is set to rise as much as 32% over the next year. The statewide action came as most of the schools held their first day of classes. And those are some of the headlines. So this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Amy Goodman is off today. World leaders from the Group of 20 countries are expected to announce today that the G20 will permanently replace the Group of 7 and 8 as the permanent Global Council for Economic Cooperation. The shift would give economies like China, India, Argentina, Brazil, Mexico, Indonesia, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and South Africa a greater say in global economic issues. A draft communique also revealed that G20 leaders have agreed to make the International Monetary Fund more representative by increasing the voting power of the so-called developing countries, which currently only have 43% of votes. Speaking on the eve of the summit Thursday, U.S. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner called for higher regulatory standards.
As you know, in the United States, Congress has a very aggressive schedule to legislate sweeping changes to our financial system that are going to provide greater protection for consumers and investors to create a more stable financial system and to try to make sure that taxpayers are no longer on the hook in the future to bear the burdens of financial crises. But we can't do this alone. If we continue to allow risk and leverage to migrate where standards are weakest, the entire U.S. global financial system will be less stable in the future. We need to see competition for stronger standards, not weaker standards.
Shortly before leaving for the G20, German Chancellor Angela Merkel urged her colleagues at the forum to focus on financial regulation.
Pittsburgh will be decisive in determining whether the subject of financial market regulation continues to be a central issue. For us, it is the most important subject at the meeting.
How far will the G20 go on the regulation of financial markets? Well, a draft communique from the G20 also suggests an effort to conclude the long-running world trade talks in Doha as quickly as possible. A report from Public Citizen's Global Trade Watch warns that the World Trade Organization has long advanced extreme financial deregulation under the guise of trade agreements and could undermine the current push for increasing regulation. For more on this, we're joined from Pittsburgh by Laurie Wallach, the director of Public Citizen's Global Trade Watch Division. Welcome to Democracy Now, Laurie.
Good morning.
Well, tell us about your sense of what will happen in terms of financial regulation.
There's an incredible contradiction where the summit communique is going to, on one hand, talk about regulating finance, and at the same time, they're going to talk about adopting the Doha WTO expansion, and a huge part of that agreement is deregulating finance. And the problem is that the G20 commitments aren't binding. It's a commitment of faith on the countries about what they're going to do domestically. But the WTO rules are very binding and enforceable by sanctions. And so it's hard to know if it's ignorance or it's cynicism. But if the Doha round goes into place, all of the world's countries will have a commitment not only to keep in place the existing WTO deregulation dictates on finance, but to deregulate further right in the midst of what seems to be a global commitment to re-regulate.
Now, is there any, among the countries now that are going to be getting increased attention in terms of the G20's growing role now in world economic affairs, are there any countries specifically that are trying to lead a fight for a greater regulation?
Well, see, this is the most peculiar aspect of it. The European Union, as you just mentioned, Angela Merkel, among others, have been pushing for more regulation. In fact, they want the G20 to have to establish a global floor of regulation. The U.S. hasn't been for that. It's not going to be in this communique, but they've really been pushing. But simultaneously, it's the European Union that is the major instigator of deregulation. And so the big development is we finally were able to get documents that actually explain what the plan is for the WTO Doha round. And it's the European Union that's been pushing the worst of it. I mean, they literally want a provision that is a standstill, a freeze in place on regulation, while simultaneously they're calling for re-regulation. You can't have it both ways.
What's your sense of how of the Pittsburgh protests as they've been developing in the last few days? Any impact at all in terms of how the world leaders are regarding those protests at all?
Well, unfortunately, the thing that has been evident here is an incredible overreaction as far as trying to squelch the possibility of the protesters having any proximity to the actual venue. And so there's a ratio of something like, 10 policemen bristling with gear to each protester. And it's really a sort of, to me, it's a horror show in the context of free speech and civil liberties. I mean, there's obviously a need to secure the president's safety and that of other heads of state, but this is above and beyond. And they've brought in police from places like Miami, who are just, as we saw with the FTAA ministerial, stormtroopers looking to beat up kids. It's just a worrisome feature every time there is a major summit, the attempt to basically make it impossible for the public's message to be heard by the leaders.
Laura, I'd like to ask you about the role of Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner. Here in the United States, he's leading the The efforts now to increase regulation over the financial sector. But he played a previous role under the Clinton administration in what was happening at the WTO in terms of financial deregulation. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, this is actually a serious problem. So most people don't even realize that the World Trade Organization has an agreement called the Financial Services Agreement that explicitly applies to over 100 countries and mandates major deregulation. Just for instance, it has a rule that you cannot have a domestic law, even if it applies equally to foreign and domestic companies, that limits the size of a financial service firm, insurance, banking, securities. So when everyone talks about putting into place rules about too big to fail, there's a WTO dictate that says you can't do that. A lot of other really extreme deregulation rules. That agreement was never brought to a vote in Congress. So a lot of members of Congress have no idea it's there. Well, one interesting fact we found was, although Daddy Bush started the negotiation, Clinton is the one who locked it up. And it was actually Geithner, when he was in the Treasury Department working for Robert Rubin during the Clinton administration, who was the lead Clinton administration Treasury Department negotiator. So he is, in a way, the guy who closed the deal. And so he knows about it. He has to know about the existing agreements. And so, theoretically, he should be the guy who's most aware of the perils, in the sense that he was part of the whole Clinton-era deregulation, including domestically. I mean, the busting of Glass-Steagall, which, by the way, we listed in the WTO as one of our commitments to reform Glass-Steagall, because it created firewalls between insurance, securities, banking. It, you know, kept banks from gambling with our savings. Good idea. The WTO commitment lists reforming Glass-Steagall, getting rid of it. That all happened during Clinton. So not just at the WTO, but domestically, a lot of the folks who came from the Clinton administration who are now in the Obama administration, Larry Summers, Geithner, were in on this. So now Geithner is talking about re-regulating domestically, needs to get on that WTO piece of it, cannot have a Doha round that has more deregulation. I mean, the basic principle here should be do no further harm. But then they have to go back and fix the WTO rules. And we're actually going to be launching a campaign with some of the unions and others, and it's being launched around the world to work on that. You can see more on our website, which is tradewatch.org. This is something that actually can be fixed, but it's going to take a lot of public attention to make the leaders do it.
So you're saying, in effect, that if the Congress attempted in one way or other to reinstitute a form of Glass-Steagall or to regulate the ability of the growth of these too-big-to-fail banks, that the United States could be running into conflict with with the World Trade Organization Financial Services Agreement?
So this agreement was in 1999, which was at the peak of this sort of lunacy for deregulation. So it itself, the Financial Services Agreement, for instance, has a rule that applies that you can't regulate according to size. The U.S. then took on additional commitments, as did about 30 other countries, mainly rich ones, but a couple of developing countries, and that's called the Understanding on Commitments and Financial Services. And that agreement is deregulation on steroids. So the U.S. actually has a specific WTO commitment that's called standstill. And in that commitment, we've agreed to basically lock ourselves into the place of deregulation that we were in 1999. Now, obviously, Congress is talking about re-regulating, but in our WTO commitments, we've basically agreed in the areas we've bound, and we've bound everything. We did take one very important exception in the area of derivatives. That would be for onion futures. We bound every other kind of security stock derivatives, but we took a reservation for onion futures. It's a really scary set of limitations. Now, it's obvious that there's an imperative politically to re-regulate. The question is, if sincerely there's going to be re-regulation, this back door deregulation has got to be closed. So the existing WTO rules have to be changed, and obviously the Doha round's further deregulation has to be stopped. But a big part of this is we need to make such a ruckus about it that basically a huge spotlight is shined on the issue, because there are a lot of very powerful financial service interests. By the way, they're the ones who wrote, largely, the Financial Services Agreement in cahoots with the government. There's a book from an American Express guy talking about how he and AIG and the others wrote these rules. Those guys want more of the same. I mean, One of the agreements that we found would be put into place automatically if the Doha round were adopted, as the G20 communique calls for, is a limit on accounting regulation of the accounting sector, that was co-written by Arthur Andersen. I could not make this up. This is actually the document. It's done. And so the last thing we need are these limits. And so basically the work that we all have at hand is to beat the banksters on a variety of fronts. It's going to be a big fight domestically, but we're not going to be successful domestically nor around the world. We're in less powerful countries, and maybe the U.S. and Europe get away cheating the rules a little bit at the WTO, but the other countries around the world don't have that discretion. So it's not just a matter of what we need domestically, though it's critical. You don't want granny's pension robbed, your mortgage gone. But on top of that, for the other countries, we've got to fix these WTO rules and stop the Doha round.
Well, Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch Division, I want to thank you for being with us. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Homestead town, homestead town, used to be the story of a glory boom town. Homestead town, homestead town, when the mill was there and steel workers were around. Pilgrims came and settled to work upon gold, from the iron and the fire in the days of old. Place full of churches and a watering hole, bowl of maker and Jesus soothe your soul. Be the story of a glory boom town. Homestead town, homestead town, when the mill was there and the smoke was all around. Road signs pointing from everywhere. You were the forge of the universe, the belly of the bear. Streets full of people in the middle of the night. Jobs that you knew. Men and women making steel, working overtime. Win the big war from behind the line.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Leaders and delegates for the G20 arrived in Pittsburgh Thursday evening under the shadow of a police crackdown on protesters. Heavily armed riot police were out in force all over the city and used tear gas, stun grenades, smoke canisters, and sound cannons, which direct extremely loud, shrill sounds. This is believed to be the first time sound cannons have been publicly used in the United States. Well, Pittsburgh is no stranger to protests. The city has a long history of labor uprisings. For more on the changing face of this former steel capital, we're joined by longtime Pittsburgh resident, historian, and labor organizer Charles McAllister. He is a retired professor of industrial and labor relations at Indiana University of Pennsylvania and the former director of the Pennsylvania Center for the Study of Labor Relations. His book is titled The Point of Pittsburgh, Production and Struggle at the Forks of Ohio. He was a machinist at Union Switch and Signal in the late 1970s and is the founder of the Tri-State Conference on Steel and the Steel Valley Authority, both active in the Mon Valley plant shutdown struggles of the 1980s and 90s. Charles McAllister, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Well, tell us first your sense of the protests and how Pittsburgh has been brought back to onto the world stage, in essence, with the G20 summit there.
Yeah, it was very interesting. I was down near the front lines of the two different anarchist groups that tried to march downtown, and there were, 500 to 1,000 police directly where I was standing. And it was ironic because it was about a quarter of a mile from the 26th Street crossing where in 1877 the Philadelphia militia marched into the yards, pushed about 10,000 strikers and supporters into a bottleneck at that crossing, and a rock or two was thrown, and the militia opened fire point blank into the crowd and killed 20 people, including a woman and a child, at which point the Pittsburgh militia, who had been sitting on the hillside watching this, was seen throwing away their uniforms but not their guns, and they went after the Philadelphia militia, and a 14-hour gun battle ensued in which the militia was driven out of town under fire all the way across the Allegheny River and about 10 miles outside of Pittsburgh they were still being fired at. So it was amazing standing there. I was there with maybe 100 Pittsburghers curious standing there and waiting for the anarchists to arrive. And they got one of the contingents got lost in our crazy network of streets. And I thought if somebody throws a bottle down, there was a whole group of us standing on a rise above the scene, we could have a very nasty situation here. We had one protester standing there with corporate greed, and the all suddenly two contingents, about 100 each of police began putting on their gas masks and raising their clubs against this one guy with a sign about corporate greed. So it was a very tense moment and could have turned into something very nasty. Basically, though, the Pittsburgh police were to be generally, certainly in this case what I saw, credited. They were the most level-headed and the most experienced group there. What was more scary were some of these outside police groups which don't understand the local terrain and the local people.
What's been the reaction of Pittsburgh residents, both to the protests and to the basically cordoning off of the downtown area for the G20 summit?
Well, there's been, I think, a lot of resentment about it. Virtually, the way the terrain is here, virtually all the buses have to pass through downtown. And basically, it's the poor and the working class who use the buses. So there has been a lot of disruption. So it's very mixed. I mean, in the comments of the very working class or lower class neighborhoods that I was in the other day, it was very mixed. I mean, some people were cheering the kids on and saying, go to it. Others were saying, what are you doing here? Get out of my neighborhood. So it was very divided. Generally, the young people and the anarchists did not attack any mom-and-pop type stores. They rolled garbage cans into the street and things like that. It was later in the evening, apparently, in Oakland, where most of the breaking of windows took place, and that was largely, according to this morning's papers, a University of Pittsburgh crowd who was broken up by the police after the dignitaries left the Phipps Conservatory. The police moved on this group, and that's when most of the destruction or physical destruction took place. Today there's a large peace and social justice march. It's permitted. It's a very long march, and we'll see what happens. That march will come from Oakland, where last night's violence was at its peak, into downtown. They're going to be stopped at the security perimeter, and of course there's all kinds of potential for disruption by individuals and groups who want to disrupt, or by the various police forces that are here, which are truly astounding. About 4,000 police are on the streets. So I had to walk here this morning. Entries are blocked for private vehicles from the entire downtown. It's a lockdown city. I kept saying to people as I was standing on the corner, this is what democracy looks like.
Let me ask you about how Pittsburgh itself is faring. It was long the steel capital of the United States and Western Pennsylvania, a center of coal production as well. How has the latest economic crisis and financial collapse affected Pittsburgh and Western Pennsylvania?
Well, in fact, the latest one hasn't affected it as much as the rest of the country. Basically, because we collapsed in the 80s and early 90s. And so this is being touted as we're the great transition, the great example of a transition to a new economy. The problem with that analysis is that our population was cut from 1960 at 740,000 to 320,000 now. Our working class, 200,000 industrial jobs were lost in southwestern Pennsylvania. And they're all over the country. It's what we call Steeler Nation. There are 9 Steeler bars in Montana. We have people all over the country, and those folks didn't go there willingly, and they still love this town. They have a lot of nostalgia for it. But that was the great industrial working class really was dispersed here earlier. So this great success that's touted here is really not replicable. We don't have a place to put them. In the 1980s and early 90s, the economy in other parts of the country could absorb the industrial refugees. This is the whole country is in trouble now, and this is not a solution. But during its heyday, Pittsburgh was arguably for 50 years the most productive place in the entire world. It produced unbelievable amounts of coal, steel, glass. It invented basically alternating current. It was where oil was first refined. It was where a lot of modern food processing was invented. This town was really a founder of industrial society on the global scale. At present, we produce almost nothing here.
And what kind of jobs have replaced those industrial jobs?
Basically, medical. We have a huge medical center. We have a heaviest concentration of universities, both of which are nonprofits and don't pay taxes into the city coffers. So the city is basically on the verge of bankruptcy for years, cutting services to the neighborhoods. The suburbanites, who are two-thirds of the in Pittsburgh workforce, pay a pittance toward upkeep of the city, and so the entire burden of the city really rests on people making $33,000 a year, which is what the average wage in the city of Pittsburgh is. So it's an incredibly inequitable tax system. People are angry about it, and of course, the right-wing commentators try to direct people's anger toward the government. Government's full of plenty of sins here, but the real problem is the corporate dominance, which has skewed the whole system against the working class.
Well, the city is also being touted now as a green center, and the convention itself, or the G20 summit itself, is being held in a center that boasts having lots of green technology. Your sense of whether the potential for replacing those steel jobs with new green jobs?
Well, this is from the very beginning. The first day I saw this in 1973, I saw Pittsburgh. I thought it was one of the most beautiful cities in the world, and I've been in 55 countries, hitchhiked in 35 of them, and it's much more beautiful now. But they're claiming that they made it green, but they really was not governmental action. The only action was leaving and closing all of the industrial production here. That's what made it green. So it was not positive action. It was really negative action that caused the city to clean up. There's a lot of wonderful efforts at green buildings, certainly support all that. But I'm much more interested in, I think the Steelworkers Union and others are much more interested in, is we want green manufacturing. We want solar panels, wind. We want mass transit. I've been involved for years trying to get a maglev system built in the United States. The only place where it's being built commercially is China. That was a chance to revive high-tech manufacturing jobs. The establishment here really does not want manufacturing. They were happy to see the industrial working class be dispersed from here, had been their longtime antagonist, and they're really not interested in manufacturing at all. And that's very deeply rooted here, and it's very deeply a class issue, because Pittsburgh once had a huge middle class, industrial unionized with benefits, family wages, middle class. That has been dispersed, and what we have now is a growing two-class system. Very wealthy, those who benefit from the new healthcare economy, global economy, and then people who are in the service sector who make qualitatively different wages.
And you mentioned a history of the union movement there in Pittsburgh and Western Pennsylvania. The AFL-CIO recently had its national convention and elected Richard Trumka, someone well known to you and folks out in Western Pennsylvania. Do you see any hope in any changes in the American labor movement that may facilitate or make it possible for a resurgence of that working middle class?
Well, I think Richard Trumka is a very intelligent guy. He's a militant guy, and I think Leo Gerard here with the steelworkers is one of the most sophisticated and labor leaders in the country. And I think the reason why the difference between here and Seattle is that the labor movement basically stood back here. I think out of respect for President Obama. He came to the AFL-CIO convention last week, promised a health care reform, which would have a public option. He promised employee free choice. And also, he took direct action in terms of the dumping of tires by China onto the American market. And I think those things were very much appreciated here. They're certainly going to try to hold the Obama administration to its promises. But I think, at this point, they're relatively optimistic. We definitely need employee free choice. I mean, the issue back in 1877, right near where we were standing yesterday, was wealth versus commonwealth. And the commonwealth is suffering, and great wealth has been thriving. And there has to be a way to extend regulation, universal global standards of labor, of human rights and environmental rights. Those are the three key things, I think, globally. And I think Leo Gerard in particular, the steelworkers understand this very well. They've reached out to unions all over the world. They've been very involved with the Sierra Club and the environmental movement. They understand this need to have environmental rights along with labor rights. And I think that's the way forward. And hopefully we can get somewhere with getting the workers' right to have a voice on the job and expand the power of the labor movement and begin to both regulate the finances, which is what this is ostensibly about, this meeting in Pittsburgh, but also to create global standards of labor rights, human rights, and environmental rights.
Well, Charles McAllister, a retired professor of industrial and labor relations at the Indiana University of Pennsylvania, I want to thank you for being with us. He's also the author of The Point of Pittsburgh, Production and Struggle at the Forks of Ohio. Well, we now want to talk about a new overview of research on global warming has found climate change is happening faster and on a broader scale than scientists projected in 2007. The report, which was released Thursday by the United Nations Environment Program, aims to update predictions issued by the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change 2 years ago. It concludes evidence of human-generated global warming in the last half century is, quote, unequivocal, and would change the planet dramatically by the end of the century unless greenhouse gas emissions drop sharply by 2050. The new findings come in a week where the issue of global warming is at the fore. On Tuesday, world leaders gathered in New York for a one-day UN summit on climate change, and the issue will also be on the agenda today at the G20 summit in Pittsburgh. The efforts all lead up to the major climate summit in Copenhagen in December to update the 1997 Kyoto Protocol. Among those who spoke at the United Nations this week was the Nobel Peace Prize-winning Kenyan environmentalist Wangari Maathai. She was chosen to speak on behalf of international civil society. In her address, she called global warming the challenge of all time.
Unlike delegations and negotiators, Your Excellencies have the power to turn this around in Copenhagen. There is no time to lose. This is the challenge of all time. Addressing it will take collective political will. No part of the world is immune. We are all in this together, irrespective of our level of contribution to the problem. Business as usual for any one country would be a tragedy.
Well, for more on climate change, Wangari Maathai joins us today in our Firehouse studio. She's a Kenyan environmentalist, lawmaker, and civil society activist. In 1977, she spearheaded the struggle against state-backed deforestation in Kenya and founded the Green Belt Movement, which has planted some 45 million trees in the country. She's also been an outspoken advocate for women's rights and democratic development, and in 2002, she was elected to the Kenyan Parliament. For her work, she was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004. She's the author of several books. Her latest is The Challenge for Africa, I want to welcome you to Democracy Now.
Thank you very much.
What was your reception like at the United Nations, and how do you feel your message was received?
Well, as you said, I was greatly honored to speak on behalf of the people, of the civil society, and the reception was very good. In a way, I was the people were trying to say, well, it's the leaders who have the responsibility to agree. And based on the science that we have now been given, the leaders must make a commitment for an agreement that is going to replace the Kyoto Protocol and that is going to make sure that we don't continue emitting more gases than we can take.
And you must have obviously been watching what is happening in the United States with the Congress here and the efforts to finally tackle climate change here by the Congress. The House of Representatives has passed a bill, but the Senate still must pass a bill. What do you see the Obama administration and the United States Congress, their role on the world stage on this issue?
Well, I think the world is very encouraged. We are definitely very happy that the United States of America is on board this time. I know that in Kyoto, they did not support and they never signed the Kyoto Protocol. And as a result, we didn't go very far. So we are very encouraged. We are hoping that the American people will call their senators and convince them that there is no time to waste and that it is very important for the United States to provide the leadership. Because besides the fact that the United States of America is the greatest contributor to the greenhouse gases per capita, it is the world leader. And if she is committed, if she comes forward, then the rest of the world is going to come forward. And we saw that in the United Nations General Assembly on Tuesday, and it continues. The leaders who are talking are really committed. And I was happy to see how China responded, how Japan responded. The President Obama was very committed, but there were no specific data. But I know that it's not coming until we approach Copenhagen.
Well, I want to get your response to some of what President Obama had to say about climate change in his address to the UN on Tuesday.
It is true that for too many years, mankind has been slow to respond or even recognize the magnitude of the climate threat. It is true of my own country as well. We recognize that. But this is a new day. It is a new era. And I am proud to say that the United States has done more to promote clean energy and reduce carbon pollution in the last 8 months than at any other time in our history.
That was President Obama. Your sense is that last statement that he made, is that accurate? In the last 8 months, the United States has done more than its whole history?
Well, I'm not sure. I don't know. I do not have the data. He must know. But what was significant is for him to admit that indeed the United States now is not going to use science as an excuse, and it's not going to say that perhaps it is not human-induced greenhouse gases that are causing the trouble. And that has been very significant because that was the major excuse in the past. And we hope that this will influence the senators to agree that indeed we can no longer shovel this issue aside. And I would like to say this. If the more than 4,000 scientists who have been working on this issue are wrong, this is one issue that we cannot experiment with. We cannot wait until the seas rise, the rivers dry up, and our people are dying and migrating and running away. We cannot wait to see more fires such as we are seeing in California, erratic fires. We cannot wait to see the kind of floods that we see in Bangladesh, that we see in West Africa. We are already seeing islands that are literally drowning. So let us not experiment with our lives and that of our children.
And in the upcoming gathering in Copenhagen, obviously, will be crucial to any efforts at slowing down climate change or reversing it. What do you feel are the main issues that that not only the rest of the developing world, but the countries of the advanced West will have to deal with? Obviously, there's the issue of whether there will be actual agreed-on goals for reductions in emissions. But what are the other issues that you think are critical?
Well, one of the issues that we have been following up is the issue of forests. scientists tell us that 20% of the greenhouse gases are coming from deforestation and forest degradation. And we think that, therefore, forests should be made part of the solution. They were set aside in Kyoto, and the government said they will talk about it later. They never did, partly because the United States was not on board. So we hope that the forests will be on board. I'm quite sure that we will come to an agreement of some sort. The measure of commitment will be how much they will be willing to cap, to reduce the emissions, and the measures they will take to ensure that developing countries and upcoming economies are willing also to play their part. And I'm hoping that especially in countries like in African countries, that our leaders will really seriously commit. We have a huge forest in Africa, the Congo forest, and I happen to be the goodwill ambassador for that forest, to really encourage African governments not to think that it should only be protected by the countries that are within the Congo. This is an issue that is important for the entire region, but also for the whole world, because these the forest in Amazonia, the Amazonian forest, the Congo, and the forest in Southeast Asia are extremely important for global climate.
You've even made the argument that preserving and expanding those forests creates jobs for the developing world. How so?
Precisely. You know, the Greenbelt movement has championed the tree planting, and I can say with confidence that you can actually create millions of jobs of young people planting trees, protecting forests, and rehabilitating degraded forests. It is something that can really be good for the economy. So the talk about green jobs is not just about solar, wind, and other high-level technologies. It's also physical digging holes and planting trees and making sure that they survive.
And also, I'd like to ask you about how the election of President Obama, what kind of impact it has had, not only in your country, obviously, but throughout all of Africa.
Well, I think President Obama has been a great inspiration to Africa. As you know, Africa has been bashed for so long, and she has found it very difficult, especially in the last 50 years or so, to really give good governance examples in Africa. And so for the election of Obama, this is a new challenge so that Africans can begin to see themselves differently and reflect themselves differently. And I know in Kenya, for example, he is a great inspiration to the youth. And I'm sure throughout Africa, people see him as a new era for Africa.
Well, I want to thank you very much for spending some time with us. Wangari Maathai, Kenyan environmentalist and founder of the Green Belt Movement. She's a 2004 Nobel Peace Prize laureate. Her latest book is The Challenge for Africa. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a moment. The United Nations Security Council held a special summit Thursday to discuss nuclear nonproliferation and disarmament. It was an extraordinary meeting on another front. President Obama became the first U.S. president to chair a U.N. Security Council summit, and the meeting marked only the fifth summit-level meeting of the Council in its 63 years of existence. The Security Council unanimously passed a resolution aimed at shoring up the international commitment to limiting the spread of nuclear weapons. While the resolution did not mention Iran and North Korea, several world leaders, including President Obama, referred to the nations in their remarks.
Made it clear that the Security Council has both the authority and responsibility to determine and respond as necessary when violations of this treaty threaten international peace and security. That includes full compliance with Security Council resolutions on Iran and North Korea. Let me be clear, this is not about singling out individual nations. It is about standing up for the rights of all nations who do live up to their responsibilities.
The U.S.-drafted resolution calls for further efforts to achieve a world without nuclear weapons. But critics of the resolution said it failed to include mandatory provisions that would have required nuclear weapon states to take concrete disarmament steps. The resolution also lacked any call on nuclear states to halt production of fissile materials for nuclear weapons. We're joined by John Burroughs, executive director of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy. He recently met with several UN missions of Security Council members regarding the summit. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Yes, good morning.
Well, your reaction to this unprecedented agreement.
Right. Well, it was really an astonishing time. It was the first time that heads of states have gathered to address the question of nuclear weapons just on its own. And it was a time when President Obama was following through on his April 5th, 2009 speech in Prague, where he declared the goal of achieving a world free of nuclear weapons. And he said some very strong things there. He said that as the only nuclear power to have used nuclear weapons, the United States has a responsibility to act. So the Obama administration was showing we are determined to go forward with acting. And the resolution did call for ratification of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. It did call for negotiation of an agreement banning production of fissile materials for weapons. It did welcome U.S.-Russian talks on reductions. But as you said in your introduction, it really was not transformational. It was more, in a sense, a sort of an affirmation of the existing agenda. And that includes Security Council action and resolutions over the last decade or so aimed at stopping the spread of nuclear weapons and preventing their acquisition by terrorists. And the resolution, in fact, had a few new wrinkles in that regard.
What about the issue the following day, then the president or the Times, New York Times is reporting now that the Obama administration will be accusing Iran of having a secret production facility, an underground production facility.
Boy, that's big news. I didn't catch that. What's happening with Iran is that there's a meeting of the permanent five members of the Security Council, plus Germany, the United States included, early next month. And it seems that the plan is, if Iran doesn't agree to limits on its nuclear program, that the United States is going to push for strengthening already fairly serious sanctions against Iran. Frankly, I'm not sure this whole approach is going anywhere. And one of the things that came up interestingly in the discussions by the leaders in the Security Council was the fact that both Iran and North Korea have been ignoring or defying Security Council resolutions over the past few years. And as Obama and the French leader and others were indicating, this calls into question the effectiveness of the Security Council. One of the things I think that needs to happen is the Security Council has to become more representative of the world. Why aren't, India and Brazil and Indonesia, why don't they have some status in the Security Council as well? I think that would make it more legitimate with respect to questions like Iran and North Korea. However, there was no mention of such changes yesterday.
And the issue of, obviously, that there are no... nothing is mandating any of the governments to begin a process of either reducing those who already have nuclear weapons or stopping any kind of development efforts in terms of nuclear weapons.
Well, the entire resolution was in the form of calls, welcomes, urges, encourages. It didn't have any mandatory provisions at all. And this is in contrast to resolutions that have been adopted regarding Iran and North Korea and terrorists over the past few years. So it wasn't only on the disarmament part that it wasn't mandatory. But the basic point is certainly important, and that is that, you know, Obama has had just beautiful rhetoric, marvelous rhetoric on the need to move towards a nuclear weapons-free world. But the agenda for doing so far is pretty limited. And to be fair, you know, it's a tough thing to get even things like the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty or reductions with Russia approved in the U.S. Senate. And probably the Obama administration wants to get those things in hand before moving further. But the fact remains, if you're in the rest of the world, you look at this resolution, you say, this seems to be mostly about preventing the spread of nuclear weapons. What about the weapons that are in the hands of the existing nuclear powers?
What does the resolution say about those countries that are not part of the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, countries like Israel or you mentioned North Korea, India, and Pakistan?
Right. North Korea has announced its withdrawal from the treaty, but that's still subject to negotiation as part of the six-party talks. But one of the disappointments about the resolution was that it did not include any reference to the need to achieve a zone free of nuclear weapons in the Middle East. This would not have been a new step. It's something that the Security Council itself has called for in the past. It's something that's been called for in the context of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. But no mention of it, despite the fact that President Obama spent a lot of time in his speech to the General Assembly on Wednesday talking about the Israel-Palestine conflict and bringing that to an end. So that was lacking, the nuclear weapon-free zone in the Middle East. There was a call on all the countries outside the Non-Proliferation Treaty to join it. That's sort of pointless in the case of India and Pakistan. They're going to have to see progress towards global elimination of nuclear weapons before they're going to really want to play ball.
And in terms of how dramatic a change is U.S. policy now on this issue compared to the previous administration?
Oh, it's a new world. It is a complete reversal of Bush administration positions on a wide range of fronts. And there's the very strong commitment to notions of cooperation and international rule of law. As I've already indicated, so far the concrete measures that the Obama administration has been talking about, they go back to Clinton administration positions, the Test Ban Treaty, the Fissile Materials Treaty, U.S.-Russian reductions. So in that sense, it's been sort of a resuscitation of Clinton administration positions. But I think the potential is there for much more.
And in terms of where this resolution goes from here, are there any planned UN actions after this at all?
Well, the Security Council said in this resolution that it remains seized of the matter, but they did not establish a subsidiary body, a committee of the Security Council to deal with these matters. They didn't say we're going to meet again at a certain point. I think we're probably going to see some follow-up in the Security Council at some point, but the next big step is the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference next spring.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, John Burroughs, Executive Director of the Lawyers' Committee on Nuclear Policy. This is Juan Gonzalez, and that does it for today's show.